It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Since 2015, police officers in Milwaukee have been outfitted with body cameras in an attempt to increase transparency and improve relations between officers and citizens. But is that effort working? We talk with a researcher about how Milwaukee residents are feeling about the city's body camera program, as well as their level of trust in their police department. My guest is Daniel Lawrence, Senior Research Associate at the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center, where he researches various policing issues. Daniel, welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
As someone who works for a national research organization, what do you gain by studying attitudes about police and body cameras in Milwaukee? What can Milwaukee tell us about the rest of the country?
Absolutely. Well, Milwaukee is not a it's a city that's independent in its relationships with the communities that they police. And Milwaukee is going to learn a lot of things about how body-worn cameras can be implemented in a fair and impartial way across the city, and it be used to increase community views and attitudes towards the police department and how officers behave towards community members.
Talk a little bit about this ongoing survey that you've been doing. What are you learning so far?
Sure. So, back in a little bit of background to this study. The Milwaukee Police Department sought funding from the Bureau of Justice Assistance to develop a body-worn camera program. And in 2015, they rolled out roughly 1,100 body-worn cameras to patrol officers. Those cameras, for the listeners that may not know, they can be mounted on the head, the collar, or the shoulder of an officer, and they're used to have audio and video recordings of interactions with community members. As part of the evaluation, we were interested in learning additional context around the department's efforts and how the body-worn cameras might affect public opinion over time. So to do this, we surveyed representative samples of community members in Milwaukee each year for the past 3 years. And these surveys were with a representative sample of individuals who either worked or lived in Milwaukee, and they were conducted in 2016, 2017, and 2018.
So, by and large, how are Milwaukee residents feeling about their police department and its use of body cameras?
So, interestingly enough, and actually perhaps not surprisingly, the knowledge of the program increased each year as the program expanded. In 2016, roughly one-third of the city's community members thought that the officers were wearing cameras, and this was about 6 months after the first rollout of the cameras. And knowledge of the program nearly doubled to 63% in September 2017 and jumped to 76% in June 2018. And knowing about the cameras is really important to forming attitudes about their use. Community members can really only have an opinion about the body-worn camera program or understand its impact on police-community relations insofar that they're aware that the cameras are being used. So this increase in knowledge is really a necessary step for improving perceptions and transparency of the police department.
So this is the third year in a row you've surveyed Milwaukee residents on this issue. How have, you said that there's increasing awareness of body cameras. How have attitudes toward law enforcement changed over that time?
Yeah, so this is a critical question. And one of the questions that we asked is, thinking about the Milwaukee Police Department, how often do they treat people with dignity and respect? And this is an important indicator of, in the literature, what's referred to as procedurally just behaviors. Which have shown that when officers exhibit these behaviors, community members can be more satisfied with the encounter, they're more willing to cooperate with the officer during an encounter, and it can increase their trust and confidence in the department and the officer's behaviors. In Milwaukee, overall, for each of the years, roughly 6 out of 10 respondents felt that MPD officers were treating people with dignity or respect frequently or almost always. But this did drop slightly from 63% in 2016 to 58% in 2018. More importantly, though, diving deeper into the data, we found that by quite a large margin, community members who were Black held the least favorable opinions about respectful treatment by MPD officers. Their attitude steadily declined from 48% in 2016 to 30% in 2018. And these findings really are suggestive of the historically challenged relationships that the MPD and the Black communities in Milwaukee and throughout the country really face with each other.
So the introduction of the body cams to the equation did not help improve relations between the black community and MPD. Is that that's your conclusion?
I wouldn't necessarily say that. We released a report that can be found at urban.org earlier this year, back in May, that looked at the outcomes or the impact of body-worn cameras associated with officers' behaviors. And what we found overall is that the cameras themselves lead to a reduction in subject stops, and there's a reduction in the amount of officers who received a formal community member's complaint. So we found that the body-worn cameras did impact officers' behaviors in regards to community members filing citizen complaints. We didn't specifically separate that out across different race groups. But I would say that the body-worn cameras are improving officer behaviors in that regard.
Daniel Lawrence is with us. He's a senior research associate at the Urban Institute, and we're talking about how Milwaukee residents are feeling about their police department's use of body cameras. Daniel, you're issuing a few policy recommendations as part of this report. Let's talk about those recommendations for a moment. One of the things you're asking for is that departments should standardize, expedite, and publicly disseminate their process for releasing body-worn camera footage. What would this do?
So this is really to make the practice of having body-worn camera footage a similar process across the board for all types of encounters. We've seen numerous cases where the release footage might be delayed when the police department or district attorney is using it in an ongoing investigation. And this is obviously for a due process reasoning. But there is a need to protect. There is a need to protect the investigation, but it also must be weighed carefully against the releasing of the footage within a reasonable time frame. The community members they certainly have an expectation that that body-worn cameras should be footage should be released, and the department should follow a standard practice for investigating and releasing footage.
So the process needs to be consistent across the board, but also you say that departments should clearly communicate their use of body cameras and the footage they produce. What would that entail, and what impact do you think that would have?
Well, departments are capable of, one, creating a formalized policy and routinely informing the community what that policy is. It can really set expectations at the front. We've seen cases where footage is released quickly when the officer's behaviors are found to be appropriate, but then footage might stay locked away if there are questionable or negative behaviors. And this really just further separates the attitudes between the community members and the police department about, what are the police really doing? Why are community members might feel that they're pretending to protect, police departments are pretending to protect their own. And there should be a standardized practice that could formalize the policy for releasing footage.
Are you going to be doing this survey again next year, or is this going to be it?
This was the final survey, so we conducted the three surveys. The study itself ends next year. One additional component that we're looking at is going to be the actual officers' use of the body-worn cameras, so when they activate the cameras. It's standardized across the department. The policy itself is that they activate the cameras for all community member interactions, and we're going to be diving deep into the data to look at how the officers activate their cameras.
All right, Daniel Lawrence, thank you for joining me on The Morning Show.
Thanks, John.
Daniel Lawrence is a senior research associate at the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center, where he researches various policing issues. Coming up next, a discussion about student debt in Wisconsin, what it looks like for people now, and how that's changed over the years. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. One of the hottest topics in higher education today is student debt. The numbers nationwide are staggering. The average University of Wisconsin student graduates with $30,000 worth of student loans to pay off. Are you a Wisconsin grad struggling with student loan debt? Tell us about your experience. What changes do you think need to be made to deal with the problem of student loan debt in our state? Are you a student at the UW? Do you think the tuition freeze is helpful when it comes to covering college costs? Are you a student at a Wisconsin technical college? What has your experience been paying for college? Are you a low-income student? Did you receive a Pell Grant? Did you have to take special measures in order to afford school, like taking a semester off to work? What do you think should be done to address the graduation gap between low-income students and others? How can the state make college more accessible for low-income students and other people? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest this hour is Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. His piece about student debt is called "Wisconsin Grads Carry an Average of $30,000 in Student Loans. Is That Changing?" Keegan, good morning and welcome to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
In 2016, Wisconsin had the 17th highest average student debt in the nation. So what, if anything, has changed in the past 2 years?
Yeah, that what's really changed or been notable is a lack of change. So if you go back decades, even in Wisconsin, there's been a very gradual rise in tuition in the state, as well as levels of debt that students have been taking out to pay for college. Except over the past 4 or 5 years or so, that those increases have started to level off. So students are taking out about the same amounts of debt as they were last year or 2 years ago. Also some other measures, this measure called unmet need, has leveled off as well. Unmet need is basically a measure that is often used in higher education to look at how much need for financial aid do students have after grants, loans, scholarships, and what is their family able to pay. So it's very important in tracking what is the financial cost of college and how is that pressuring families.
So you mentioned that tuition started to go up. Did other forms of non-borrowing, a non-loan-based student aid go up along with tuition?
I'm not sure what you mean.
As tuition started to go up, were there other forms of financial aid that increased along with that? So, say, Pell Grants, other forms of direct aid that weren't based on borrowing. Did those go up as well or not?
Got it, yes. So there have been several steps. Back around 2010, there was a surge in eligibility for Pell Grants, and so a lot more students in Wisconsin started to receive federal financial aid around 2010 compared to previous years. Last year, state lawmakers also approved an increase, a $15 million increase in state grants, and those grants are cash in pockets. So you don't have to pay them back like you do loans. So those have definitely eased the burden on a lot of families who are trying to send students to college. Pell Grants can be cash in pockets, so those are things that you don't have to pay back. There's also quite a range of federal loan packages that students now have access to as well. So there are some options for students to pay a much lower cost than the sticker price to attend college. Some other, at individual campuses, there has been a lot of push to increase institutional grants through private donations to raise money that way. Or at one college like UW-Madison has a program that specifically targets low-income families where they can have a lot of their tuition and fees waived if they fall under a certain income threshold.
So student debt in Wisconsin has leveled off at about $30,000 over the past few years. So how are we supposed to read this? Is this a sign the problem is being solved, or at least it's not getting worse?
Yeah, I lean towards at least it's not getting worse. I think the measure of $30,000 is significant because that's a very large amount of money for a lot of families. you know, the average median income, household income in Wisconsin is somewhere in the range of $55,000-$60,000. And so a $30,000 loan when you're leaving college is a significant amount of money for a lot of families. And Wisconsin does have families that take out loans at much higher rates than elsewhere in the country. So a lot of people are facing debt after college and continue to face debt after college, and that has an array of ramifications on their financial choices in the future, things like buying a car or buying a house. If you fall into problems paying back your debt, so if you go into federal default, that can hurt your financial prospects for years to come through a lower credit score and other steps as well. So it remains a very large issue.
So let's talk about what kinds of loans these are, because I think for some of us, myself included, who went to college, say, in the early 70s, that was a long time ago, the student loan programs available at that time were federally backed. They were strictly regulated. The interest rates were very low. What we're hearing today, though, is that the kinds of student loans that students are taking out are much different. And for one thing, the interest rates are a lot higher and they're much more difficult to pay back. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think there are a lot more options in the field today, I think, for where students can get loans. So you still have federal loan programs that a lot of students can qualify for. You also have private loans out there that students can apply for. Typically, the federal loans will have lower interest rates. There are also more types of financial protections for those. And there are programs that can help students pay back loans over time. There are also now programs in the private sector to help students refinance their loans. So if you do have high interest rates, you can go to a credit union in Wisconsin and see if maybe repackaging your loans can bring your interest rate down and make it a little bit more manageable.
I mean, $30,000 is still a lot of debt to contend with. I mean, that's considerably more than I paid for my first house. How are the people you've met reporting this story dealing with that debt? What are some of the stories you've heard?
One of the stories that we highlighted in most recently was a student who recently graduated and was fortunate to get a job right out of college, and he just started paying lots of money to try to pay down his level of debt, and it really changed his lifestyle, what he was able to afford each month and what he was able to enjoy. So because he was pouring so much of his salary into paying his loan payments back. And ultimately, he had to make this choice about what type of lifestyle he wanted to live. Did he want to be spending so much of his paycheck every month to get rid of this mountain of debt, which for him was more than $50,000, or did he want to make lower payments each month and kind of have this debt lingering for much longer time, but he would have more money in his pocket in the short term? And I think that's a very, very familiar story to a lot of families that come out of college and now have to make this choice about what type of lifestyle are they able to live or do they want to live to pay off this debt over time? Is this debt something that you want to get rid of quickly, but then you're going to be paying a lot of money up front, or do you want to stretch it out over a very long time and you're paying a lot more money then because of interest, or you just have this debt lingering in your background for a very long time? And so I think it affects lifestyles in a lot of different ways.
So $30,000 is the average. What was the highest amount you found as you were reporting the story that a student reported to you?
Oh, yeah. And we've talked to students with more than $70,000 debt for an undergraduate degree, not a medical degree or a law degree, but for an undergraduate degree. Particularly students who attend private schools where the tuition can be much higher, where there might not be as much access to certain financial aid packages, those students can come out with much higher levels of debt as well. And it's Yeah.
$70,000. That's a staggering amount of money. It's something. I mean, you know, a 30-year mortgage for $70,000 would be a considerable chunk. We're at news time. We're going to continue our conversation with Keegan Kyle about student loan debt in Wisconsin. We have some callers who want to join us. We'll take them right after the news, and we need to hear from you as well. What's your student loan story? 800-642-1234. Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. His piece about student debt titled Wisconsin Grads Carry an Average of $30,000 in Student Loans, Is That Changing? Is the basis for today's discussion. We'll be back after this short break. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Students are graduating from college with crippling amounts of student loans, and we're talking about that today on The Morning Show with Keegan Kyle, an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, who's been looking into this issue. We have a lot of callers who want to join us, and let's start with Mark from Appleton. Mark, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have to say it's rather frustrating that you're this far into the show without a single word being mentioned about the massive state cuts to universities, both in Wisconsin and throughout the country, which has, of course, been made up by tuition increases. The state in Wisconsin used to support a student attending college by more than 60% of the cost. It's now less than 30%. And so, of course, tuition has risen, and now we're surprised that we have all this student debt. This actually goes back to years where there's actually a model of high tuition, high student aid, which of course leads to all of this debt. It's not to be surprised. When I went to school many years ago, it was very easy to work in the summer and pay for tuition. That's no longer possible. I teach in the UW. Many of my students are working 30 and 40 hours a week, and they still have student debt. So we shouldn't be surprised about this. If we're not willing to support the universities and our students going to school, they're going to have a high debt.
Mark, thanks for sharing that with us. Keegan, Kyle, what about that? I mean, is this really the root of the problem? The costs have gone up based on the withdrawal of state support from the UW system, and that's what's driving tuition?
Yeah, it's a very common concern that you hear in higher education. I think it's a few ways that you can kind of unpack it a little. One thing to note is that how people look at the numbers around state funding for the UW system and tuition can be looked at it a little different way. So you often hear like our funding for state UW system has been stagnant or about the same in recent times, and that's generally looking at UW funding, state funding for the UW system in pure dollars. So how much actual dollars does the state give the UW system? And those numbers have fluctuated over the past decade, but they've been about the same in the same general range of like $200 million. You know, it sounds like a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of how much money goes to the UW system each year, they've been relatively stagnant over the past decade. What's really changed is the level of tuition. The amount of money that's come from tuition has gone up quite a bit over the past decade. And so the caller is absolutely right that tuition has taken on a much greater responsibility to shoulder the cost of education at state schools. And that is part of a national trend of less of students taking on much more the cost of their education at colleges than state funding. The two trends that the caller is talking about, the decline of state aid and the increase in tuition, is much more evident when you look at these dollars at a per student level. So how much state aid is going to the UW system per student enrolled versus how much tuition money is going to the UW system per student enrolled that's where you really see changes over time, where the state has been giving less and less money per student since the 1990s, essentially, whereas the amount of money charged per student through tuition has been increasing almost every year since the 1970s. In 2011, it was that the students actually started to pay more for the UW system than state taxes through state funding. And every year since then, every year since 2011, students are paying more for the UW system education than state taxes.
Let's, Mark, thanks for that call. Let's take another call. Ben is with us in Sussex. Ben, go ahead.
Hi, calling. Thank you for taking my call. Calling as a recent graduate, 2012, just the idea of, one, you know, understanding the responsibility and investment that education brings, that it is going to cost money and you have to pay that down. And then talking about the lifestyle, changing your lifestyle out of college, right out of college, to pay down those debts. You know, I think that that's a huge part. That's what, you know, I worked for, and my wife and I, who also went on for a doctorate, you know, changing your lifestyle, living below your means to be able to pay down these debts so down the road you can live a different lifestyle. And just understanding that, you know, maybe college isn't for everybody. I don't think, you know, there's this huge push to get people in college. I don't think everyone belongs in college, first. And secondly, I see it as a business and supply and demand, and there's a continuous demand even at the prices that there are. So, you know, I think in terms of it, at that end, the consumerism needs to change as well.
Ben, if you don't mind my asking, how much debt did you graduate with?
It was about $25,000.
Okay, and but you've been able to make those payments no problem?
Yeah, so we did that, and then, you know, on top of that, as I said, my wife went on for her doctorate at Marquette, and we were, you know, lived a lifestyle that was well below our means, and we paid cash along the way, and my wife worked full-time while obtaining her doctorate in nursing. So, you know, I think it is completely possible to do these things, but, you know, you're not going to be buying fancy new cars. You're not going to be buying big old houses and things. You're going to be living in small apartments and driving old beater cars.
Okay. Ben, thank you. Thank you for the call. Keegan, how typical would Ben's story be of the students that you talk to?
Yeah, I think it's very typical. I think one of the challenges of student debt can be coming out of college and realizing how big those loan payments are going to be and what that means for your expectations in everyday life. So are you going to be able to go to the restaurants that you want to? Are you going to be able to buy the house that you want to or the car that you want to? And sometimes the reckoning of that can be very disturbing to people who went to college and paid a lot of money and now come out with a financial situation that is different than their expectations. So I think that's like a very common frustration. But that's something that a lot of colleges and even in high schools now, people are working better to inform students about what that situation is going to look like so that they go into college with better expectations about how much the situation is going to cost and what they can expect after college.
All right. Let's take another call. This time there's another Mark. This is our morning for Marks on the morning show. Apparently Mark in Romance, Wisconsin. Mark, good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for taking my call. I graduated from UW-Whitewater in 1975. My total student indebtedness at that time was $2,000. And actually, the only reason I took that loan out was I had a family emergency. Back then, corporations and the wealthy were paying a much fairer share of tax than they are now. I think it's a sad commentary that in the state of Wisconsin, our budget for the prisons is greater than it is for the university system. I was also thinking, as the last caller was talking about living, you know, a lower lifestyle, yeah, of course, you have to do that when you're dealing with student debt or going to school. But I was able to pay for all my tuition. My wife at that time was able to pay for her tuition and graduate, and we had a total $2,000 of indebtedness. I also bought my first home just 3 years after I graduated from high school. Now, as I look at retiring in a year, one thing I want to say is that, you know, spending on education is not a cost. It's an investment, whether that's for the individual or for the society. And when we start making it so difficult for people to go to college, why would a high-paying employer want to come to this state if there are poorly educated workers? And the last thing I'll say is, one, my generation has failed the people who are in college now, and for that I apologize. And two, I sure hope these young students are getting politically involved. And if you get a chance to talk to a candidate for state or federal office, put them on the spot on the issue of student debt.
Mark, thanks for the call. Keegan, Kyle, you want to comment on what Mark had to say?
Yeah, I think sounds like Mark is commenting on kind of the a few things, but certainly kind of the political relevance of college affordability this year. It is an election year. We have very prominent statewide races on the ballot. Every state assembly seat is on the ballot. Half of the state senate is on the ballot. These are people who every 2 years make very large decisions about how much money is going to be going into the UW system, how much state money is going to be going into very prominent grant programs that can help low-income families or students on more of a merit basis. There's a lot of power in state government that over college affordability and a lot of influence. So it is a very important time of year to be talking about college affordability, because the people who are elected in November are going to be making decisions next year that affect students for years to come.
Let's talk about the demographics of student loan debt for just a moment. Are there certain groups who get harder by student debt than others? What about that?
Sorry, you said student.
I mean, what's the face of student loan debt? We've kind of been talking about it in general terms. Are there demographic groups that get harder with student debt than others?
Yes. Yeah, and I think in some different ways. So low-income students in particular tend to go to more technical colleges or two-year colleges, and those institutions often have higher rates of students defaulting on their loans. And like we talked about earlier, defaulting on your loans can have really major ramifications for a person's financial future. Okay. And that's something that we haven't seen really changing over time. And there are even some... Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I want to come back to that. We have to go to a break, and then because this is an important important question. Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for USA Today Network in Wisconsin. We're talking about student loan debt. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson here with you this morning. We're talking about student loan debt in Wisconsin with Keegan Kyle, an investigative reporter for USA Today Network, Wisconsin. And he wrote an article about this recently. He's been doing an investigation on this issue. And we're talking about that this morning. Just before our break, Keegan, we were talking about the demographics of student loans and you know, who's more likely to be taking more student loans. You were talking about some differences and some areas where there are real problems with students being able to pay back loans and some default issues. Let's continue with that, and then we'll take some more calls.
Right. So I think in the background of any conversation about college affordability, there's this concern about student debt or the cost of college deterring low-income families in particular from going to college in the first place. And there are some signs that appears to be happening, though it's unclear why. So over the past 5 years, there's been a gradual decline of low-income students attending UW system schools. If you look at the percentage of students who receive federal Pell Grants, which is a common metric that is used in higher education to track low-income students. And this could be because more low-income families are are having success in getting jobs directly out of high school. You know, the economy has been improving as well as unemployment's been going down. But there's this lingering concern that with the amount of student debt and the amount of attention that student gets across Wisconsin, that maybe fewer low-income families are actually deciding to go to college. There's also been some positive trends over the past few years with low-income families, where students, low-income families, are more often graduating in 4 years, which can help bring down their college costs. But there's this gap that still remains between low-income families and other families and how often they are able to accomplish that important benchmark. In most cases, if you're a more affluent person, you're much more likely to graduate within 4 years, which means that you can often keep down your college costs a little bit more.
So what about the technical college system? Wisconsin has an extensive system of technical colleges around the state, and a lot of students go there. What do we know about the situation there regarding student debt?
Yeah, so generally the levels of student debt are lower at technical colleges because they're much more geared to be affordable institutions. They're often a shorter program, so you're not paying as many years of tuition when you are attending. But because they do tend to market towards a group that is more financially unstable, they often have higher rates of students defaulting on their loans. And I think that's one of the tragedies about kind of technical college or community colleges, which appear to a similar audience, is that they're places where that are meant to cater to low-income families and those kind of in the most need. But they often struggle to accomplish that, to get people out of their institutions in a financial stability. And that's something very much on the radar of technical colleges. They're aware of this, and they're working to improve it. And there's three that I've been monitoring that their default rates have actually been worsening slightly in recent years. And they've been doing some initiatives to try to improve how often students come out of college paying their loans, and they believe that they are going to see a turnaround in the near future where students are falling into default less often.
So we've kind of established debt and unmet need have leveled off, plateaued, if you will. There's still big problems, though. What's being done to address this at the policy level? I mean, we've got Governor Scott Walker and his Democratic challenger, Tony Evers, both saying they'll extend the UW system tuition freeze if they're elected. But, you know, how effective is that going to be going forward in dealing with the problem of student debt?
Yes, so a freeze essentially helps students now, and it helps future students. So it lowers the college costs of students who are currently in college or they're going to be in college next year. It doesn't really do much to help students who are coming out of college and have a lot of debt. That's where some other proposals like refinancing your student loans, or Governor Walker has proposed giving tax credits to people who are paying off their debts. Those types of proposals are much more targeted to help people who are in a debt situation.
So if you simply freeze tuition and the budget for the university keeps getting cut, where does the money come from to actually operate the system?
Yes, so the UW system has had to be creative in how it adjusts its budget with a tuition freeze since 2013. So one thing that they've done is try to attract more out-of-state or international students who pay much higher tuition. So that way you are increasing your revenue stream through tuition by those students. They've also been much more aggressive to seek private donations and grants and philanthropy to try to supplement what their needs are on campus. So they're trying to find alternative sources of money to essentially increase to meet their cost needs. If they can't grow their in-state tuition because of freeze, or they can't grow their state tax funding because of lawmaker decisions.
What do we know about unscrupulous lenders? We had a caller, Mary Kay, who called in to say that she had an experience where a lending company was dishonest about how much interest she would have to pay. How big a problem is this?
I don't know. She should definitely call their state regulators and federal regulators of loan lenders. And so if she was misled or has a fraudulent situation, then she should report that to authorities, and that may be able to help her immediate situation. But there are concerns. This is part of the problem that if you've been following higher education over the past decade with for-profit institutions, a lot of those ended up going under because there were concerns about very aggressive loan situations and the college institutions being misleading about the interest rates that students would have to pay or how much what they would actually get out of their degree. So it's not uncommon in higher education, but there are definitely institutions in place to try to help people that are in those situations.
We're just about out of time here. One of the things that you mention in your article, Lawrence University in Appleton has a program called Full Speed to Full Need. Briefly tell us what that's about.
Yeah, so like a lot of colleges across the state, there's been this push to try to increase financial aid for students through philanthropy. And so the idea is to lower the amount of unmet need, this measure that looks at how much money can a student not pay because of their family income situation or because of they don't have access to grants or loans. And so it's specifically targeted towards the families who are most in need for financial aid, where if they do not get that financial aid, they can't go to college or they can't afford to pay for college. So that's been a common thing across the state, is to try to narrowly target these families who are in a situation where if they don't get a little additional money, then college is out of reach.
We had a caller who called in to say that colleges are also raising extra money by raising other fees. And so it's not just tuition that students pay for. Very quickly, is that something that's going to be a problem?
Yeah, I think fees are constantly on the radar of lawmakers and students. So lawmakers set some fees at colleges for public colleges, and then students will also set some fees. And that's a perennial debate about what those fees should be. And sometimes it depends on what students want their campus community to look like and what programs they want available. And lawmakers are debating in a similar way about what programs they want to pay for on campus. So it's a very common debate in college affordability, okay. And it does impact how much students pay.
All right, Keegan, Kyle, thank you very much for joining me this morning. I appreciate your time. Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network in Wisconsin. His piece about student debt was the genesis for this program. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.